Hey, first of all, with all you internet geniuses here, can somebody set up a podcast for me? Who can do that? Is there anybody in this room who can set up a...
Yeah.
Really? You can set up a podcast for me?
Yeah, just pick one.
Okay.
They're not that hard.
I know, I just don't know how to do it. And I know that I can update it. I just need somebody to get it started and show me how to update it. And okay, good. That would really be helpful. All right. Men's workshop.
Woo-hoo.
Father, bless this time that we have together. Just pour out your spirit upon us, Lord. We want to hear from you, and we want to know how to be more and more godly men in this generation that we live in. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, turn in your Bibles to Job chapter 31. Book of Job. You guys know the basic story of Job, I hope. It's the story of this man. We don't know exactly when he lived. We don't know exactly where he lived. We don't know exactly how he came into a relationship with the living God, but he did. He had a strong, deep, intimate relationship with God. And the strength of his relationship with God was evident in the kind of life that he lived. In other words, in Job chapter 1, verse 1, it describes Job as a blameless and upright man, one who feared God and shunned evil. You would almost get the feeling from the book of Job that he was sinless, that he was perfect. Now, we know that's not true. Because number one, we know that there's only one man who is ever sinless, and that was Jesus Christ. But secondly, there are examples in the book of Job of where Job does sin. And so we're not trying to say that Job was sinless. We're just trying to explain that he was a very righteous man. Matter of fact, I don't think I have any trouble saying that if we were to put Job in the middle of this room, he'd probably be the most righteous man here, right? I mean, just in the conduct of his life. He probably lived a godlier, more pure, more upright life than any of us. Matter of fact, this is what God says about Job. Not his wife, not his kids, not himself, not his family. This is what God says about Job in Job chapter 1, verse 8. There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. Now, by the way, that's what God says about Job. Later on in the book of Job, his friends are going to discuss his character. And when Job's friends discuss his character, they're not particularly nice to him. They accuse Job of a lot of things that he never did. So I'm not talking about what his friends thought about him. I'm not talking about what his wife or his children or anybody else. God said of Job, there's nobody like him on the earth. Now, God, in order to disprove an accusation that Satan made against Job, he allowed Job to suffer tremendous loss in his life. God gave Satan permission to take away things from Job. What did he take away? He took away his 10 children. Job's 10 children were killed on one afternoon in a tragic accident. He took away Job's massive wealth and influence. You watch the business news? Every once in a while in the business news, there's a bad day on the stock exchange, right? And people are all in turmoil. Oh, I lost 15% of my portfolio. You know, my fund is down 20%. And that's a disaster, right? If your fund is down 20%, you're in a lot of trouble financially, aren't you? Job's fund was down 100%. He lost everything. All of his wealth, all of his influence, he lost it in one afternoon. Not only that, he lost his health. He went from a man who was once healthy and strong to being a man who was terribly stricken in his health. He lost his supportive wife. Not that his wife left him, but he lost the support of his wife. He also lost his supportive friends, because his friends started out standing right beside him. We're here with you, Job. We'll face it down with you. But by the end of the book of Job, his friends have turned on him terribly. Now, the other thing that Job lost that I think was his greatest loss, and I don't think you could say that Satan took this away from him, and I'd be inclined to say that maybe God took it away from him, but I can't say for certain. The greatest thing that Job lost was his sense of the presence and comfort of God. You know, isn't it that way? When you feel that God is with you, you feel like you can face just about anything, don't you? But if you feel that God has forsaken you, you feel like you can't face anything. And that is exactly how Job felt in the midst of this. That was Job's greatest agony. He had all this intense discussion with his friends. His friends were reacting to Job's own comments. And after all of this, Job's friends correct him back and forth in these long, tedious chapters of the book of Job. Honestly now, who has read the book of Job and found it very tiresome, very tedious? Yeah? You're supposed to feel that way. You're supposed to be sick of this discussion. Because Job was sick of it. And I'll tell you what, after a while, God was sick of it too. Right? God, so if you read the book of Job, and somewhere in the midst of all that discussion, you go, man, this is going around and around and around, and it's not going anywhere. You've read it exactly correctly. Because that's what it's doing. So back and forth for 35 chapters, Job debates with his friends. They accuse him, and then he protests his innocence. Now, Job waits all the way until chapter 31. The very last chapter of his own conversation with his friends. He waits until that very last chapter of his own conversation with his friends to bring up any kind of evidence of his own righteousness. I think that's amazing. If I'm a righteous man, and all my friends accuse me of being an unrighteous man, what's my instinct? My instinct is like to immediately protest and say, no, I'm really a good guy. Let me show you how. I do this, I do this, I do this, I do this, I do this. Job waited 31 chapters until he did that. Job waited a long time until he tried to answer the accusations of his friends by talking about his own righteous life. Now again, that's a great testimony to his own humility. But what is found in this chapter, I think, is really valuable for us. I'm really glad that Job told his friends, no, I really do live a righteous life, and let me tell you how. Because if he never would have, we never would have known what this blameless and upright life looks like, right? Let me put it to you this way. Job chapter 1 says that Job, another man like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, right? We all agree on that? What does that look like? What does a blameless and upright man look like in his life? You know, it's kind of interesting because for the women, we have Proverbs 31, right? Oh, the perfect woman, you know, on and on. Well, what do you got for guys? Well, in a sense, you could point to the lists that are included in 1 Timothy and in Titus for leadership in the church, right? And that's a good place to begin. But I'm fascinated by this chapter in the book of Job that shows us what a blameless and upright man is like. So, shall we look at it together here? Job chapter 31, beginning at verse 1. Look at how he begins. He's going to explain his blameless and upright life. I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? Now guys, you got to say, this is amazing, isn't it? In this section where Job is protesting to his friends, I really am a righteous man. I really do live a godly life. Let me explain to you how. What's the first thing that he brings up. This is a man older than any of us, wealthy, influential, man of power, man of prestige, godly man, living in a culture incredibly distant from us, right? Probably at least 4,000 years ago he lived. And what's the first thing that he brings up? Sexual purity. Isn't that amazing? The very first thing on Job's list, when he says, let me explain to you that I really am a righteous man, he explains to these guys about the sexual purity in his life. Now listen, his context, again, is to explain it in the sense of why he feels so humiliated by his friends. But don't miss the main point. He's explaining his blameless and righteous life. It's significant that that's the first thing on the list. That he guarded his eyes from lustful looks upon a young woman. Now this rightly indicates that a man's ability to not look upon lustful images is an important indicator of his general righteousness and blamelessness. Right, this is the first thing on Job's list. All right, let me explain about my righteous life. To begin with, Job says, I haven't put my eyes in a lustful way upon a young maiden. Now listen, I think this shows us something else too. It suggests to us that the eyes are a gateway for lust. Isn't this especially true among men? Now it's proved over and over again, both by personal experience, but also by scientific studies. What happens when a man has enticing, sensual, lust-inducing images before his eyes? Now, I don't want to... Look, this is the men's session. I don't know if they can hear us out here. All right? But when lustful images are placed before a man's eyes, he often becomes sexually aroused. Sometimes just in his mind, right? Other times he becomes physically aroused, having an erection or something, right? Now, this isn't news to you guys, am I correct? Maybe you're absolutely shocked that I would say such a word here at a church gathering. But this is true, right? Now look, let me describe this for you. If a man does something to cause sexual arousal in himself, you know what we call that? Foreplay. You're preparing, you're taking the beginning stages of sexual intimacy, of sexual contact with a person. Now obviously, if a man looks at something and doesn't complete the sexual act, it's stopped at foreplay. But make no mistake about it. That woman that you have put before your eyes and allowed her or found sexual arousal in her, you're having foreplay with her. Is that okay? I don't think so. It's not. I mean, it's just wrong. I'm not allowed to have sexual foreplay with other women. I have a wife. Now, if you think it's okay, you could take that analogy to marriage. What if your wife engaged in sexual foreplay with other men? Well, sweetie, I never completed the act, she says. You know, it was just foreplay. She said, well, what are you talking about? You can't do that. You're married to me. Well, it's the exact same true thing for us. Now listen, it's a very important thing for us to understand. Job began with this in his list. And therefore he says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. Job's ability to control himself was connected with a covenant that he made. He made a vow, a promise, a commitment with his own eyes that he wasn't going to look upon a young woman in a sinful way. Now again, it doesn't mean that he says, I have stopped experiencing lust. I don't know if it's possible, nor do I know if it's healthy for a man to never experience lust. what it has to do is be controlled, and you have to put nothing in front of your eyes that would excite it unless it's the woman that God gave you to marry. And this is what Job has understood. I want you to know that it's even more interesting than this, because Job insisted that he would not look upon a young woman in this way. You know what that is literally in the Hebrew? I don't know what it is in your particular translations, whatever language you have, but in the Hebrew, it's a maiden. It refers to a young, unmarried woman. Now, that's especially meaningful, because in Job's day, in his culture, how many wives could a man have? Right? Many, right? He could have as many as he wanted to, basically. And if a man was as rich and powerful as Job was, how many wives could he have? A lot, right? It was entirely legal and even moral by the standards of that day for Job to look upon a young maiden, right? An unmarried woman, and say, I want her, I'm marrying her, she's mine, I'm having her. That was okay in the eyes of society in Job's day. He would not do it. He refused to do it. Job restrained himself from women that others in his same circumstances would not restrain themselves from. Don't you think it's... Now, I don't think we can categorically say that Job only had one wife. But that's all we read about, right? There's absolutely no indication in the book of Job that he had more than one wife. Which again points to his godliness, doesn't it? Because even though God allowed polygamy under the Old Testament, he never blessed it. And God commanded from the very beginning that one man should be joined together with one woman. By the way, Jesus drew light to that, didn't he? Because when they were talking about marriage and divorce, what did Jesus say? He said, have you not read that from the beginning God said it was so? That one man and one woman should come together in a one flesh relationship. Job understood this by instinct because of his close relationship with God, even though it was not strictly prohibited in the Old Testament. But what I want you to understand is that the culture said to Job, yeah, sure, you can have this woman and this woman. They're young maidens. They would love to be married to this prestigious old man and be married into this fabulously wealthy household. They would love that. And Job, of course, would love it too, right? Well, he would love it sensually, but it would get in the way of his relationship with God. Now listen, this is what I love about this passage. Did you notice it? Look carefully at what he says. I've been reading off my notes and not out of my Bible, so let me turn to that passage because I want you to get the exact verse here. Job 31, okay, it's in verse 2. Look at this. This is very important, guys. Why does he say, I've made this covenant with my eyes that I will not look upon a young woman? Why? For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? In other words, when Job considered why he would not give himself over to lust, he considered what the allotment of God from above was. He understood that the young woman that he would be enticed to look upon was not God's allotment for him. She, and I'll use a biblical phrase here from the Old Testament law, she and her nakedness did not belong to Job in any sense. I think it's fascinating if you look at Leviticus chapter 18. Don't look there, just remember. Look this up sometime. Leviticus chapter 18, verses 1 through 18. It relates this principle of how the nakedness of an individual belongs to that individual and to their spouse. In other words, it says things like this. You shall not look upon the nakedness of your brother's wife. It belongs to your brother and not to you. You shall not look upon the nakedness of your father's, wife, your stepmother. You know, it just goes through and it explains. But the whole principle is this. Their nakedness belongs to them and to their spouse. It doesn't belong to you. And Job understood this. God has allotted something to me, and he has not allotted to me that woman in her nakedness. No, that's not for me. It's for somebody else. It's for her husband and nobody else. You know, if you think about it, for sure there existed in Job's day some kind of pornography. Did you know that some of the earliest artistic images we have from the time of, if you want to say, the cavemen, right? From prehistoric, what are some of the earliest artistic images that we have? They're highly sexualized personifications of women, right? Or of men. They're women with enormous breasts or multiple breasts, cave paintings, little terracotta figurines. They're men with enormous penises. These are the earliest artistic images known to mankind. Now listen, even though there was certainly some kind of pornography in Job's day, he certainly did not have to contend with the sophisticated, gigantic, and far-reaching modern pornography industry that we have to deal with today. I'll face it, guys. The availability of modern pornography has made it a much greater challenge for us to confine or restrict our visual arousal to the one that God has allotted for us. But that's what we have to discipline ourselves to do. God, you have given me the nakedness of one woman. It's either my wife or the one who's going to be my wife if I'm not married. That's it. The nakedness of this other woman, even if she is perfectly willing to take her clothes off for money and expose herself to me in some way, that's not for me. It doesn't belong to me. You know, if you think about it logically, of course it doesn't belong to you. What does the nakedness of every woman running herself about, does it belong to you? Do you have some kind of right to this? Of course you don't. Whose nakedness do you have a right to? Your wife's. Or the one who will be your wife in the future. I think it's very helpful for a man in this context to ask himself the question, whose nakedness belongs to me and whose does not? Only a very proud man or a very depraved man would think that every woman's nakedness belongs to him. And so with just a moment of thought, we understand that it's the allotment of God from above that we have to confine ourselves to. And it's only our own wife that is, if you look at verse 2, the inheritance of the Almighty from on high. So, Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes, right? That's the one reason why. Second reason why, look at here. He says in verse 3, is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Now, this is in the context of Job's self-control when it came to lust. He says, I'm going to control my eyes. I'm going to make a covenant with my eyes, with what I allow myself to look at. Why? Because I know the destruction that comes upon the wicked and the disaster that comes upon the workers of iniquity when they don't. Job has probably lived enough of his life and see men around him who have been destroyed by lust and by sexual sin and by adultery. He knows it. And might I say, you guys have probably seen it too. Maybe you've experienced it. Maybe you've experienced some of the very destructive power of sexual lust. If you haven't, certainly you've told stories or you've heard stories about guys who they've lost everything in life. Everything. They lose their marriage. They lose their children. They lose their dignity. They lose their ability to earn a living. They lose this. They lose that. Why? After the craziest lusts that they pursue. There's no logic behind this. But what they forget is that it's destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity. And guys, this is tough. It's hard for us today. You want to know why it's difficult for us today? All right, follow me with this. I wish I had a whiteboard. I'd put these figures up on the board. But if you just listen carefully, you can track along with me, okay? In the year 1500, okay, think of Europe 500 years ago, okay? What was the age of a man's economic independence? Do you know what I mean by that? Economic independence is when he's out on his own and he earns his own living and he no longer is responsible in his parents' house. His economic independence. 500 years ago, the age of a man's economic independence was 16 years of age. Okay? Do you know what it is today? Today it's about 26. Okay? So in 500 years, it's gone from 16 to 26. 500 years ago, the average 17-year-old was living on his own and earning his own living, starting his own career, whatever it would be. Nowadays, it's the average 27-year-old. Okay? In the year 1500, the average age for a man to get married was 18. And that makes sense, right? Economic independence at 16. A couple years later, you get married, right? So what do you think the average age of marriage is today? About 28, right? Economic independence at 26, you get married a couple years later at 28, right? Average age of marriage. Okay, so you got those figures in your mind? Now let me throw you the third one that really complicates it. In the year 1500, the average age of male puberty, when the hormonal changes that happen in a man's body that make him a man physically, right? And let's face it, you know what those years were like, right? I mean, man, you want it. You want women. You want sex. I mean, that flood of hormones that goes through your body. The average age of puberty in the year 1500 was 20. Today, it's 12. Okay, so think about it. 500 years ago, economic independence at 16, you'd get married at 18, and you'd reach puberty at 20. Now, isn't that nice? By the time you reach puberty, man, you got it all set up, right? What is it today? Puberty at 12, economic independence at 26, marriage at 28. That's tough, guys. It is. And I'll be very honest with you. There have been times when I have really protested against God. God, that's not fair. It's really wrong. You expect too much of us, God. You expect us to fight against these enormously powerful biological urges that are within us. Not to mention of how the culture is all the time trying to shove it at us. This is really, really difficult, God. You ask too much of us. Haven't you felt that way before? I hope I'm not the only guy here. You don't have to say anything. I'll trust that you agree with me on this, right? Now look, but this is what I've come to understand. You know what, guys? It does ask a tremendous amount of us. But you know what? I'll just be straight with you. Especially in the Western world. How else are we going to suffer for Jesus' name? How else are we going to lay down a valuable sacrifice to Jesus Christ? Do you realize that God has given you a very powerful urge, biologically, hormonally, sexually, whatever you want to call it. Very powerful. And you know what? Listen, I know it doesn't feel like this, but it will not kill you if you don't fulfill it. Right? This is the strongest urge in your body that can be unfulfilled without harming you. Because I'll be honest with you, there are men who go their entire lives without having sex, and they're no worse the wear for it physically. Right? This is the strongest urge that you can deny yourself without harming yourself physically. And God says, I want you to lay that down as a living sacrifice before me. You know what? God is asking a lot of you. He is. But this brings him glory. This brings God tremendous glory. And I'll be very straight with you guys. I suppose there's going to be some women who listen to this on the tape later, and I don't really care, but they're not around here right now. I would say that almost all women never realize how great of a sacrifice it is for us. if they understood what a battle it is for us to do what Job said, to make a covenant with our eyes and not to give ourselves over to lust, if they understood what a battle it was for us to walk in that, they would probably freak out if they knew what a battle it was. But they would respect us tremendously for being faithful in that battle. And I'll just lay it out to you guys. This is what God wants us to lay down before His throne as part of a living sacrifice. Look, today, there are many biological, cultural, economic, social, technological factors that make it much more difficult for a young man to make a covenant with his eyes, to not look upon a young woman in the sense here made by Job. It's really hard. I remember speaking with a young man in the UK, and he was being very honest with me. And he said, "Wow, look, you know, David, I had such a problem with the internet and pornography on the internet. And, oh, it was such a battle for me." He goes, "So I tell you what, you know what I did? I just got rid of my computer. I just couldn't have it anymore. You know, and I'm never going to have one again, or if I do, I'm only going to do it when I can handle it, having all the blocking software." He goes, "But you know, I know how to get around the blocking software, so I just forget it. You know, I just don't have a computer anymore." And he goes, "Now what I'm really struggling with is downloading it onto my mobile phone." Isn't that funny? I mean, our corrupt hearts can be so ingenious when it comes to figuring out ways to sin. Now, it's much more difficult for us to do that today than it was 500 years ago or in Job's day. But listen, by the power of God's Spirit, it can be done. And our obedience in this area is a wonderful, precious, living sacrifice made unto God. It's a way that we can really practically and definitely present our bodies as a living sacrifice unto Him, as in the way described in Romans 12, 1 and 2. Oh, by the way, let me show you another principle here. Look at verse 4. "Does he not see my ways and count all my steps?" That was another thing that helped Job in this context of saying, "I've made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a young woman." He considered that God's eye was upon him all the time. All the time. Isn't it interesting that most of us men indulge in ungodly visual arousal, right? We look at things we shouldn't look at with the at least temporary delusion that God doesn't see what we're doing. If we would make ourselves fully aware of that Jesus is with you all the time, what are you going to do with that? "Hey, Jesus, look at this on the screen. Wow." What? Are you going to do that? Are you going to take Jesus with you into the video rental place? When you go and you get that DVD that you know you have no business? "Jesus, look at this one." Jesus, He's with you all the time, guys. Because I'll tell you, you're taking Him there whether you like it or not. Right? He's there with you. Job understood it. "Does he not see my ways and count all my steps?" We can't hide it from him. We put ourselves under this kind of delusion that we do. Now look, I find it fascinating that that's the first thing Job lists when he talks about this. And I have to say, that's relevant to my life. It really is one of the biggest struggles I face in my life to keep my life pure before the Lord. Is to say, I'm not gonna let my eyes rest upon lustful images. That's not easy. Let's face it, the women don't always make it easy, right? They don't. God bless them. Sometimes out of ignorance, sometimes out of this. I'm not even gonna say I'm blaming them. It's my own corruption that's at fault more than anything. But you know, it's not easy. But it wasn't easy for Job either. And that was the first area of godliness. Now look, because I don't want to spin this out on and on and on, because we could spend another hour here, I want you to take a look at the other areas that Job talked about. Because even though this was the first, it was not the only. And I don't want to act for a moment, because you know what? Maybe there's some of you men that you have this area of your life under control. You really do. I'm not trying to say you're some like Zen master and you never feel passions or this or that. But all in all, this area of your life is under control by the grace of God. Praise the Lord. It would be easy for you to think, well, all right, man, I'm as righteous as Job is. It'd be easy for you to think that that's the only thing that God cares about. And it's not the only thing. That was the first thing, but it was not the only thing of Job's life that he had to deal with. So let's take a look at some of the other ones. Okay. If you're making a list, a blameless and upright man, number one, he's in control of his sexual passions. That's number one. We saw that in the first four verses, right? Number two, he's an honest man. Look at it, verse 5. If I have walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way, or if my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. Do you know what Job's saying here? Saying, I live a truthful life. I'm not afraid to be weighed upon honest scales. Examine my life in an honest way. Matter of fact, Job was so confident of his honesty that he said, if I'm not honest, let a curse be put upon me. Then let me sow and another eat. Let somebody else take everything I've worked hard for if I'm not an honest man. Now listen, Job demonstrates very plainly here another aspect of his godliness. He was an honest man. A blameless and upright man is an honest man. Now, do I have to tell you guys that you have to be honest people? You do. I'll tell you one place you have to be honest. You have to be honest in paying your taxes. I take it it's the same with Danes and Norwegians and Finns. But the Swedes, they can take quite a little bit of pride in the way that they cheat the tax system, right? It's almost a badge of honor if you cheat the tax man in a very creative way, right? And I understand, if I had to pay the taxes that you Swedes got to pay and whatever else, I'd be strongly tempted to. But it's not honest. You know, being a pastor for so many years, most of the time I would stand out back, you know, at the doors when people were leaving for the service, you know, at the end of the message, and I'd say hi to people and shake their hands, and you hear a lot of comments, you know, well, fine sermon, pastor, and please don't ever ask them, well, what was it that you liked about it, because they'll just give you a blank stare. You know, it's just fine sermon, pastor, whatever. And so I would do this commonly, and I received at that line, people going out the door, one of the nicest things that anybody's ever said to me after sermon. I was preaching a sermon, I can't even remember the text. I think it was on Romans chapter 13, where it talks about paying your taxes and being honest. And I just said, don't cheat on your taxes. And I had an older man come to me, a man who was a businessman. He comes back, shakes my hand, looks at me in the eye, and he says, I'm going to go home and change my tax return. Well, that's how it should be. Now, I'm not trying to say that's the only place you have to be honest, but that's a beginning, right? You have to be honest. This is not exceptional Christian behavior. This is normal Christian behavior. We have to be honest people in the things that we do. That's the mark of a blameless and upright man. Okay, next. A blameless and upright man honors his marriage and does not commit adultery. Starting at verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down over her. For that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment, for that would be a fire that consumes to destruction, and it would root out all my increase. The next area of integrity that Job proclaimed has to do with faithfulness to his wife within marriage. Now, he understood that this had to do more than just with the sexual aspect, but also included the idea of his heart being enticed. Right? Did you notice that? Right there in verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman. Guys, let me warn you that your heart can be enticed by another woman long before you ever commit sexual immorality with her. Right? As husbands, we have to say, I will only allow my heart to be given over to my wife and to no one else. Job touched upon a very significant truth here. You can allow your heart to be enticed by another woman. And what does he say about that? He says it would be iniquity. He says of that it would be iniquity deserving of judgment. Now you know what this tells us? We have control over whom we allow our heart to be enticed by. I've talked to married men about this. I mean, I recall one particular counseling session I had with a guy. He had not committed sexual immorality with this woman, but he had crossed way over the line. And he confided with me in his office, in my office. And he said, I love her. I love this other woman. I mean, I feel alive with her. I feel something with her that I don't feel with my wife. And I just looked at him and tactfully and gently but strongly, I said, who cares? What possible difference does that make? Okay, let's say you really do love this other woman more than you love your wife. Let's say that's the case. Let's say you feel magic with her that you don't feel with your wife. Let's say that that's the case. Okay. Isn't it true that God sometimes calls you to give up the things that you love the most for His glory? Yeah? All right. This woman is sin. This woman is disobedience. You got to give her up for the glory of God. But I love her. So what? Your heart has been enticed by her. Okay. Next question. You give her up. You give her up, and you know what? Your heart will become unenticed by her. And if you'd start paying attention to your marriage and being the husband you should be, you will find that your heart will get enticed by your own wife all over again. You want to tell yourself the problem's with your wife. It's not with your wife, it's with you. Here's my 100% fail-proof example of this, right? Solomon. How many wives did Solomon have? I get the figures mixed up. I think he had 300 wives and 700 concubines, or was it 700 wives? I don't know. 1,000 altogether. He had 1,000 legal bed partners. Let's put it that way. Now look, you know what God showed me through Solomon? And I needed to hear it. I really needed to hear this when God showed this to me. God showed me through Solomon that if one woman isn't enough for you, 1,000 won't be enough. If one woman isn't enough with you, for you, the problem is not with that woman. The problem's not with your wife. If one woman isn't enough for you, the problem's with you. Because 1,000 won't be enough for you. That's the way it is. So, don't allow your heart to be enticed by another woman. If it is, get it unenticed. And let your heart be enticed all over again by your wife. It can be done, and it should be done, and it must be done. Why? Look at what he says there. It's in verse 12. For that would be a fire that consumes to destruction. And then he says here, and would root out all my increase. I hate to bring this up because it might hit too close to home for some of you guys. And I don't mean it to, but you just need to hear the truth. Haven't you known men? I have. They're married. Their heart becomes enticed by another woman. They get divorced. And between the alimony and the child support and supporting their new household and all the rest, it has rooted out all their increase. It's gone. You know, they don't live nearly the life they live. All their money's gone in alimony and child support and settlements and this and that. Why? Because they allowed their heart to become enticed by another woman. I guess what I want you to know from this is that you really do have control over that in your heart. You don't feel like it. Our modern age doesn't tell us so. Our modern age wants us to hear, you know, love has its own reasons. Love justifies itself. What a nonsense. You have control over this. And if your heart is enticed by another woman, it's because you've allowed it to be so. And you can change it. And you can make your heart enticed all over with your same wife again. Okay? So, blameless and upright man, number one, he's in control of his sexual passions. Number two, he's an honest man. Number three, he honors his marriage and he doesn't commit adultery. Number four, he's not prejudiced against those thought of as less than he is. Let me show you this, verse 13. If I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, how then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? Now listen, if you understand the age that Job lived in, this is absolutely revolutionary. 4,000 years ago, I'm guessing anywhere between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, Job was proclaiming, that servant, that slave in my household, they are just as human as I am, and they deserve my respect and my good treatment. That's awesome. And Job says, I'm bound to treat them well. Now look, we don't have servants. We don't have slaves. But we run across people that are thought of as less than us. Right? I don't know. Gypsies, immigrants, this, that, Swedes, whatever, yeah. Danes. Ouch. You know, but you understand what I mean, right? Listen, how you treat those people is a huge measure of your godliness. How you treat those whom your culture looks down upon is a big measure of your godliness. It just is. Job was a blameless and an upright man because he treated other people with dignity and respect, even though the culture despised them. Well, that's exactly what you and I are bound to do. We are absolutely bound to do this by the Lord Jesus Christ. Don't ever forget it. Don't ever lose that perspective. I think that this is the best thing to tell our daughters. I tell my own daughter this, but I also tell the young women at the Bible college this as well. I tell them, listen, don't you pay attention to how that young man who's all hot after you, don't you pay attention to how he treats you. You know, he just wants to win you over. He'll tell you whatever you want to hear. He'll, you know, be sweet and charming and all that. Don't pay attention to any of that. He's just trying to win your heart. See, you pay attention to how he treats the little people or the low people in his life. Because that's the measure of what kind of man he is. You know, the person who comes and cleans his table at the restaurant, the person who takes out the garbage, you know, this person, that person, whatever they are, the low people or the people who are thought of as low. You look at how he treats them. Because that shows what kind of character he really has. Well, it shows your character too. In control of his sexual passions, an honest man, honors his marriage and does not commit adultery, is not prejudiced against those thought of as less than he. Next, he does not take advantage of the poor or the weak. This begins at verse 16. If I have kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless could not eat of it, but from my youth I reared him as a father and from my mother's womb I guided the widow, If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, and if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, when I saw I had help in the gate, then let my arm fall from my shoulder. Let my arm be torn from the socket, for destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I cannot endure. What's Job saying? I didn't take advantage of the poor or the weak. Now listen, sometimes we can do this, can't we? Sometimes in business. Sometimes in something is, you know, somebody's selling something and they're really in financial need. I don't know, I'll just paint an example. You know, and it's mythical, but, you know, you want to buy a television, a computer, something like that from somebody. You answer an ad in the newspaper and you go look it up and you notice that these people are poor. They're poor. And they're trying to sell this and you go, wow, you know, they're selling this pretty cheap. And you go there and you understand why they're selling it so low. It's because they really need the money. But then you figure, you know, they're so poor, I bet I could offer them less. They really need the money. I can knock them down a few hundred kroner more, right? Can I just tell you, that's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong to grind the poor down and take advantage of them. You should look to be generous to the poor. If you were in that situation, you should be diligent to pay that person a fair price or maybe even a little bit more than what's fair. Because God will honor you for it. But there's other little ways that in our lives we can take advantage of the poor or the weak, and we should not do it. How we treat the poor and the weak among us is a huge measure of our character. And Job could say, I'm a blameless and upright man because of the way that I treat the poor and the weak. Next, Job says that he was not greedy and he was not an idolater. Verse 24, if I had made gold my hope or said to fine gold, you are my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much, if I observed the sun when it shines or the moon moving in its brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. Now, interesting. In this section, he weaves together two ideas. First of all, I haven't been greedy, and I haven't been an idolater. It's funny because in Job's day, those two concepts were a little more separate. Today, they're virtually the same. Because how do most people practice idolatry today? Not by bowing down to a little statue, but by bowing down to some material thing, right? Living their life for a material thing. We've got to be very careful about the lives we live, that we don't live for greed and we don't live for idolatry. Can anybody tell me the gods that ancient Israel had to battle with most for idolatry? I'm thinking of two gods in particular. Who are the gods that ancient Israel was always troubled with idolatry? Baal, okay, number one. Number two? Mammon, no. Ashtaroth, right. Baal and Ashtaroth. Can anybody tell me what Baal represented? You know what Baal was the god of? Well, indirectly, weather. Baal was often represented with a lightning bolt in his hand because he was the god of weather. Now, in an agrarian society, who do you have to depend upon to bring the rain so your crops will grow? Baal, right? You don't get the rain you need, you don't get the weather you need, you don't have a harvest, you fail. But if Baal is kind to you, you make a lot of money, right? That's it. They didn't want big crops for the sake of just having big crops. They wanted big crops because it meant financial success and economic security. Baal, economic success and security. Okay, Ashtoreth. What was Ashtoreth all about? Fertility. Now, that also connected to crops because they wanted their crops to be fertile. But what did they especially want to be fertile? their wives and their concubines, right? And how did they worship Ashtoreth? By going to a cultic prostitute, right? What Ashtoreth was all about was sexual pleasure. The two greatest idols that Israel had to deal with were economic success and security and sexual immorality. I'm glad we've come a long way from the days of Israel's idolatry, right? Good heavens! Don't you see that's us today? I mean, nobody would be so crude as to worship Baal or Ashtoreth. But you can't tell me that our culture is any less given over to Baal and Ashtoreth than they were in the days of Israel. So now do you see what Job means? I haven't given myself to greed, and I haven't given myself to idolatry. That's how it has to be for us. Next, verse 29. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him, indeed I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse upon his soul. That's one. That point right there, Job did not hate his enemies. That proved that he was a blameless and upright man. Now listen, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. You will have your enemies. You will. People will come along who will be against you, and they shouldn't be against you, and they just are, and they're your enemies, and that's bad. But you're absolutely bound by the gospel of Jesus Christ to not hate them. I don't ask you to pretend like they're your friends, but don't hate them. Don't give in to hate. Now notice the second one he mentions, it's hospitality, beginning here at verse 31. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there who has not been satisfied with his meat? But no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to travelers. Pause right there. He's saying there, I've been hospitable to people. I've shown hospitality to other people. That again is a great example of living a blameless and upright life. You know, hospitality means more than just allowing or inviting people into your home, which is a great thing and we should be doing it. But tell me, what does the ancient Greek word translated in the New Testament hospitality mean? Does anybody remember this? Yes. Lover of strangers. You love strangers. And you know what? That's a precious thing. That's a mission field right there. To love the stranger. To love the unlovely, to love the rejects. It's a measure of a blameless and upright man. And then the final one, beginning here at verse 33. If I have covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silence and did not go out of the door. Here Job insists that he did not try to hide or to justify his own sin. I don't hide my sin. I'm open about it. Right? And we can do that, right? We can be honest about our sin. What would you do if another guy in this group right here came up to you tonight and he said, listen, man, would you pray for me? I'm really struggling with this sin. And this is the sin. I'm really struggling with alcoholism. Really, I drink too much. I'm really struggling with pornography. I'm really struggling with homosexual thoughts. I'm really struggling with laziness. You know, you could just go whatever it would be. What would be your reaction if another guy in this room came up to you and confessed that to you? Would you say, you wicked and sinful man, get thou away from me. Do not pollute my purity with your presence. Nobody would say that, right? You'd put your arm around that guy and you'd pray for him. You'd say, look, let me talk with you, let me pray for you. then why do we think that somebody else is going to treat us differently if we would talk to them about whatever it is that we're struggling with? Isn't that funny? You would never reject somebody who came to you. Well, do you think you're so much better than anybody else in this room? You're not. You really can go to your brothers. You really can talk to them about the things you struggle with. Well, look, that's pretty much it. Let me go through the list one more time, right? A blameless and upright man, what does he look like? Well, number one, he's in control of his sexual passions. Number two, he's an honest man. Number three, he honors his marriage and he does not commit adultery. Number four, he's not prejudiced against those who are thought of as less than he is. Number five, he does not take advantage of the poor or the weak. Number six, he's not greedy and he's not an idolater. Number seven, he doesn't hate his enemies. Number eight, he shows hospitality to others. And number nine, he does not hide or try to justify his sin. You know what? That's what Job's life looked like. And you and I might say, well, look, God doesn't expect me to be as holy as Job, does he? Might I say, and I don't want to condemn anybody here, especially myself, isn't it fair to say God expects more from us than we hear about from Job? Because we have a covenant with Jesus Christ that Job never had. We have an infilling of the Holy Spirit that Job never had. Job had a lot more excuses than we do. We have the life of Job himself to learn from, which Job didn't have. And so I don't think this is beyond us, guys, Jesus Christ working in us. That's what I just think we should give ourselves over to and say, Lord, do what you will with. Can we just take a few minutes out? Let's just have some open prayer, all right? I'm just going to stand up.